Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to She Started It with Angelica Malin, the podcast that celebrates incredible, inspiring women who are at the top of their industries, from food to fashion, law to politics. This is a podcast about celebrating female entrepreneurship, power and potential, exploring what it really takes to be a trailblazer in today's world. I'm your host, entrepreneur and journalist Angelica Malin, and every week I'll be asking a new guest for their three career turning points and answering the question we've all wondered at some point, how did she start it? She Started It with Angelica Malin is kindly sponsored by Bloom & Wild. If you're like me and you love having fresh flowers around you while you're relaxing at home, but I hate having to carry them around with me all day, and who's ever home long enough to arrange a delivery anymore, Bloom & Wild have got us covered. They're the UK's top-rated online florist, and they deliver right to your letterbox. So you can get fresh buds, ready to flower, they can last up to 10 days, and you don't even have to worry about being home for the delivery. They'll give you £10 off your first order with the code SHE. Straight and simple, S-H-E. They offer free next day delivery up to 10 p.m. They ship across the UK, France and Germany, so they've got you covered. So head on over to bloomandwild.com, use the offer code SHE so they know I sent you, and treat yourself. Alice Living is a health and wellbeing influencer, best-selling author and personal trainer. Using her own experience of transforming her lifestyle, Alice has inspired a shift in the modern-day consumer's attitude to healthy eating and exercise. Alice's genuine message and passion has seen her build an audience of over 630,000 followers and release three best-selling books. A qualified personal trainer, Alice also works with clients one-to-one to help them reach their goals. Alice's global reach has seen her appear on leading publications such as the New York Post and Women's Health UK. She also hosts monthly Living Well panel events and has launched two of her own collections with Primark, as well as working with brands such as River Island, Sweaty Betty, Herbal Essences and Samsung. She's also been made an ambassador for Women's Aid. Thank you, Alice.
Thank you. That reads as a wonderful intro.
It just reads as a full life, I would say.
It's so weird, though, because it's happened in such a short space of time. And I suddenly get to the point now where I'm like, oh, God, what next?
Yeah, that's a lot.
It is. But it's great. You know, it's been a really exciting few years. I think it's hard when a lot of stuff happens in a very short space of time because it takes a long time for your, almost your body and your brain and your, like, growing up to catch up with everything that's gone on. Like, it, all of that stuff happened in a time where I was between the ages of 21 and 25. And I think that's such a, like, a time when you're, like, really finding out who you are. You know, you're, like, I finished uni and I got my first job and I moved out of my home and I lived on my own for a bit, and all of those things are, like, really molding who you are as a person. And yeah, I think now I'm sort of letting the dust settle, and I did have a period definitely towards the end of last year and the start of this year where I just had to, like, take a step back and be like, it's been a really busy time.
Because you're right, they're already quite fluxy years.
Yeah.
And then add all on to that, like, loads of career changes, really exciting opportunities. It's quite a lot to deal with.
Yeah, it is. And I think I have always tried to just embrace whatever path I feel like my life is taking me. Like, I had never planned to be on this trajectory in terms of what I'm doing with my career, but it just so happened that I, you know, I fell into it and then I really enjoyed it. So then I pursued X and then I pursued Y, and each sort of decision in terms of my career has then led on to something else. And I've always done things with 100% passion, and I think that's something that's really important is, if you love what you do, there'll always be a route to kind of success. There'll always be a way. You know, when one door's closed or something hasn't worked, I've always found another route.
So you haven't had that much of a plan?
Like, zero plan. Absolutely no plan. I look at other people who are like particularly organised and structured with their life and their success and everything, and everything's, like, sort of got a plan and they've very much got, like, a strategy. And the amount of times that I've been asked, like, so what's your 5-year plan? And I'm like, I have absolutely no idea. You tell me. You've probably got more idea than I have. Like, I don't plan, and, you know, that might be to my detriment. I don't know. But it's just never been something that I've really felt comfortable to do, just because you never know, you know, and particularly in the industry that I work in, everything is so changing. Jobs come in, jobs go, you know, you think you're going to get something and you don't, you think something's going to happen and it doesn't. So you can never 100% do stuff, sorry, with 100% certainty. And so my moral is just to enjoy what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. You know, I work very, very hard and I'm not saying that I don't. But my hard work is put into passion projects that I have control over, but then also sitting back and letting things come to me and taking things that I think are going to make me genuinely happy.
On a more kind of gritty topic, is that ever challenging financially? If it's like you're not quite sure the regularity in which things are coming in or going to work out?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. And I think talking about money is such a grey area. And it's something that particularly influences are like, oh, God, no, don't talk about money.
Because it makes us feel vulnerable, right? We don't want to talk about money.
Yeah, and because I just think, you know, for a lot of people, there's still that kind of like that British, that stiff upper, you know, like my family never really spoke about money. So it was never something that I felt comfortable coming out and being like, yeah, I'm motivated by money. Mm. Look, I think I find myself sitting in both camps. To some extent, I am motivated by money naturally. You know, I think there are certain things that I think get you out of bed in the morning, and earning money is one of them for me, and I'm not ashamed to say that, but it's not my sole motivation. I'm grateful to be in a position where I absolutely love what I do. You know, if money was my sole incentive to in life, I wouldn't have chosen to be a personal trainer because the pay isn't great, but it is one of the most fulfilling things that I do as part of my huge career that has lots of different parts. So yeah, I mean, that's something in itself. I think it hasn't ever worried me because I've always, you know, even from a young age, I've always been quite, I don't know how to describe it, I've been quite tenacious in that, like, I've always known that I was going to work. Mm. Even if it was a shitty bar job, I've always worked. I remember when I was at school and I had a very, like, you know, privileged upbringing, and when I was in sick form, I remember, well, no, actually, even before that, when I turned 16, I remember all of my friends getting, you know, brand new cars and stuff. And my mum was like, right, 16, write your CV. She stood over me at the computer as I wrote it up. And she was like, you're going to take it around to every bar going. And whoever have you, you're going to take that job. You need to start earning your money. And, you know, that was something that I didn't see any of my friends doing. And I was like, why me? Like, and the injustice that I felt at the time. Oh, my God. I literally remember being like, this is so unfair. You're the worst mother ever. But actually now I look back and I think, thank God you did that. Because it instilled in me such a good work ethic from a young age that I remember when... So I've had many sort of like changes in the plan. And one of them was that I was going to go to university and study history. And I got to the point where it was literally a couple of weeks out from going. And I was like, I can't do this. I want to do musical theatre. That was my biggest love, was to perform. And I turned around to my parents and said, I can't go. And my mum said, okay, fine. If that's what you're going to do, that's cool. But you need to get a job and you need to earn money because you're going to pay for your education. So couple of days later, I went out. I found myself a job in a pharmaceutical company doing their filing and paperwork. Oh, wow. And I worked in a dark room for, I think it was 7 or 8 months, until I had enough money to then go out and start auditioning for theatre schools. And, you know, like, some people would be like, yeah, so you should. But also, like, the environment that I'd grown up in, people got handed stuff on a plate.
Yeah.
You know, it was very, very nepotistic, you know, because your dad worked there, you're going to get a job there and that kind of stuff. And my mum particularly was very, very driven to not let any of us, me and my brother or my sister, you know, get any handouts in life. She wanted us to work hard for it and to know the value of hard work and know the value of money and earning your own money. And I think, yeah, going back to your question, I don't worry too much about that because I think I know that whatever happens, I will always, you know, it might not be the best income, but I'll always, have
work.
Money and I'll always work and I'll always throw myself into whatever it is that I'm doing 100%.
I suppose that to break that down, if I was to psychoanalyze it, I feel like that's a security in yourself rather than perhaps a security in the actual job that you're doing. Mm. But it's a belief in yourself that you know your own work ethic and you know you'll work to make it work.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that's definitely right. Yeah, I think.
I'm just being a mini therapist.
No, I love that. Thank you.
Welcome. I'll charge you later. So for each show, I ask my guests to tell me three key things that were turning points in their careers. Please could you tell me the first one that you chose?
My first turning point. Well, actually, I think I already just talked about it because I didn't write that down there, but I didn't think about that. But I, you know, speaking about money, one of my first things that was a big, big turning point and a big kind of like moment where I think a lot of people were like, what the hell are you doing? Was when I decided not to go to university. Mm. You know, I did really well at school. I was house captain and I'd like to think that I, you know, did fairly well in my A levels and my exams. And going back to the work ethic, I worked really, really hard at school. I revised, you know, my brother and my sister were the complete opposite to me, but I was so motivated and driven, you know, with my exams and stuff. I would get up, I'd have a schedule, I'd revise really hard. And I did really well, but there was just something in me that so was not made for that world. Mm. And I, you know, no matter how much I tried to convince myself that I thought it would be a good idea to go, I couldn't. And there was always this niggling thing that, like, I absolutely loved the theatre and I loved performing and I'd always done it from a young age and I couldn't let that dream die. And, you know, I knew, and so many people around me, particularly like my grandparents and my friends would be like, Alice, you know, you're going to be out of work. You're going to be a jobbing actor the rest of your life. You're going to be waitressing tables. You know, I remember my mum even saying that, like you need, she didn't say it in a bad way. She just said, you need to be prepared for the reality of what your life might hold. And, you know, you're not going to be earning good money. You might, you know, have to work two or three jobs just to get by. But if it's what you want to do, then that's fine. And my parents have always been very, very good at accepting whatever it is that me, my brother and my sister want to do. You know, my sister went off to fashion college. My brother didn't even go to university. He went straight into a job. They've never pushed us to do anything. And I think that was really important because I could go and do musical theatre. I thankfully got into a really good college. I went to Bird College. And those 3 years at theatre school shaped me as a person more than any other time in my life. It was so I don't even know the word. It was so hard, but so important to go through all of that, of those struggles. I met some of the best people I've ever met, you know, some of my closest friends. But also I was thrust into an environment that was so incredibly diverse compared to where I'd come from. You know, I'd grown up in such a bubble. I grew up in, like, you know, very much middle class family, went to private school. And then suddenly I was in a year with 80 other people that were from so many different backgrounds to me. And it was a real eye opener. And I suddenly had this kind of realization of there's a big wide world out there and there are lots of other people that are far less fortunate than me, and a definite feeling of gratitude. But yeah, I'm so glad that I did that, and if I hadn't, I wouldn't be where I am today.
Yeah. And where did you go after theatre school?
So I was very, very lucky to get a job, which doesn't happen very often, but I graduated and walked into my first job in Annie the Musical and ended up touring the UK for a year. Again, an incredible opportunity, something that if I could have my time again, I would go back and do a million times over. It was so amazing. And suddenly I'd gone from working so hard in those 3 years to think, like, and the possibility of performing was like a distant dream, to then doing that every single night, you know, playing to packed out houses of people and standing ovations and stuff. That was amazing. And, you know, it was really like my dream, basically.
I remember when you were in Annie and you were doing Instagram. Yeah. I remember you had these kind of dual lives.
Yeah, it was really strange because I'd like put pictures up in my wigs and stuff before I was getting ready for a show in the evening. But, you know, at the same time, things were really taking off with my blogging. And I think what I found really difficult was I had an incredible year, but it was really coming to the end of that year and having spent this you mean you're really thrust together with a very small group of people, and they become your family, basically, because you're touring all together. You see them, you spend more time with them in the day than you do without. And seeing those people going out for jobs and starting to audition for stuff and, you know, getting no's, and I was like, hang on a second, these are some of the most talented people I've ever come across, and they're getting turned down from auditions. And that was a real reflection of, is this an industry that I want to go into? And it was a real moment where I was like, look, I absolutely love the performing. And I would, if I could isolate that and do that for the rest of my life, I would. but it's the fact that it comes with a real kind of like, not dark side, but a real tough side of the industry where a lot of the time you're out of work, but also a lot of the time you're really judged for the way you look. And I actually came to the end of that year having, you know, with all the blogging and stuff, that was really taking off and I was really finding my feet and finding confidence. And I actually, it was less the being out of work that I didn't think I could handle. It was, I don't know if I'm mentally strong enough to deal with the constant comparison and the judgment on my physique and my look and how I am for the rest of my life.
So you kind of just wanted to take yourself out of that space?
Yes, completely.
And where were you in your fitness journey during Annie?
I mean, I was training. I was probably a bit too obsessive. I would get up, you know, a typical day on the show was me getting up at 6, going to the gym, prepping my meals for the day, and then going and doing one or two shows, walking everywhere because I was saving money because I was on like £400 a week. So I would, like, even if I was staying 40, 50 minutes out of the city, I would still make sure that
was
I
was that what you were paid on the show?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
I mean, it's like, it's not great. Yeah.
It's like a job that, like, you're famous basically, and it's that.
You're staying in people's spare. Like, there were a few real horror moments. I remember my first week of tour, and I had messaged this guy I went to school with him actually. And I'd messaged him on Facebook and been like, I know that you're at Newcastle Uni. Can I come and stay with you? Because I'm going to be in there. It was the first city we went to on the tour. And I rocked up to this house. This guy wasn't even there. I had a room where there was a drip from the ceiling coming down onto my bed. None of the lights worked. So I got back from my first show that evening. And I went to turn on the bedroom light and nothing turned on. So I was like taking my makeup off in the dark. There was no duvet cover. So I slept on a bed without a duvet. I mean, there were some amazing times. Like, I stayed in some really cool digs, but a lot of the time they were really scummy. And it was a real, like, kind of, it was a real, it was very, what's the word? It was very like, not even humbling, it grounded
just
you.
Just like a nice experience, really.
Yeah, it grounded you and it gave me some like realization of actually, like, get down off your high horse, Alice. Like, this is how some people live and this is reality. And you either like it or lump it and you just get on with it. And I did. And I, you know, now I'm like, I don't have any airs and graces and with things like that because I just think, well, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, it does. It teaches you a lot, doesn't it? To bring up a slightly difficult subject, I know you've recently become a Women's Aid ambassador.
Yes.
Can I ask a little bit about that relationship? Was that happening during this time?
No, it was before. It was before. That was when I was at school. So I was in year 11 and, year 12 it was. It all kind of kicked off between year 11 and year 12. So I was
really
15.
Young.
Really young. And it was my first sort of proper relationship as such. Yeah, it was a very difficult time. I think I look back on it now and I actually don't know how I got through that period as well as I did. I think I was a lot more mentally scarred than I realised. And things that have only... And to be honest, I think sometimes your brain has such a good way of protecting you that you sort of, like, my brain, for example, just almost like wiped the entirety of that year, so that I had such little memory of what happened that it was only recently, probably in the last year to 2 years, and I started to have these really awful flashbacks of stuff, you know, things that had happened. I was like, God, this is so weird. Like, am I dreaming this or did this really happen? And I genuinely had to, like, question myself. And then the more that it happened, the more I realised that actually, like, the layers of protection that my brain had put on me were starting to peel back. And I was starting to remember that that did happen. And at that point, I was like, do you know what? I need to go and speak to someone about this. I need to get therapy. I need to almost have that cathartic experience of just saying, okay, this happened to me and I'm over it now, but I just need to get it off my chest that these are the things that happened. And so I did, and I've never felt better. And I think doing that then prompted me to say, actually, or to realise, sorry, that actually there are a lot of people that follow me that I think would really relate to everything that I've gone through. And I have this amazing opportunity where I've got a platform to reach thousands of people, to raise awareness and to do something good.
How difficult was that decision to speak so publicly about it?
It was like 90% good and then 10% absolute fear, you know, because you never know. There's always that, like, I felt very, very strongly about doing it, But in the back of my head, there was that tiny voice that was like, what if? Mm. What if he sees this? What if he shows up on my doorstep? What if he finds out where I live? Mm. And for a while, it's particularly like straight after when there was quite a bit of press around it, I remember, because I get up very, very early in the morning to walk to work, that sort of early morning walk, being really scared for like a few weeks, just being like, oh my God, is he behind a corner? Like, you know, because going back to what had happened, the assault took place when I was like, I'd ended the relationship and I was at school, and literally out of nowhere, this car pulled up onto the pavement of Berkhamsted High Street, and this guy attacked me in the middle of the street, you know, so it's so unexpected. And I think it's that fear of like, oh my God, what if that happened again? Like, what if he like jumped me from behind? And so, yeah, 90% of me was like, I absolutely know that I need, this is something that I need to do. But then 10% of me was like, oh my God, what are you doing? You mad woman.
Yeah. Have you seen him since that you entered the relationship?
No. I didn't even sit in the same courtroom. Like, my dad sat in the courtroom and I sat in the side room like this. So, yeah, no.
Absolutely crazy. Well, it's very brave of you to come forward, and I think that it would have inspired a lot of people.
Thank you.
So talk to me about your second turning point, which was books.
Yes. So writing my books, I know, like, it's mad to think I'm an author. Like, I still feel when I call myself that, I'm like, God, that's so weird. But yes, yeah, so I published my first book in May 2016. And it was a real turning point, because I felt as though that was me really solidifying that this was going to be my career now, that this was going to be something that I was actually going to do for a living. I was really young, and if I had my time again, I don't know if I'd have said yes to doing the books then.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Just because I'm like, God, I didn't know enough. Like, I was so naive. But when you're young and someone thrusts this incredible opportunity in front of you, and you're like, yeah, cool, amazing. Like, you do. You jump at the chance. And it's only with hindsight now that I think, maybe I'd have taken a bit more of a measured approach. Maybe I'd have said, come back in 2 years' time when I've learned a little bit more. But I didn't. And I can't live with regret. I cannot do that. So I've just got to embrace that was where I was then. And I might be in a different place now, but it's not to say that, you know, that wasn't a great time. And I wouldn't sleep at night if I went to bed with regret. So yeah. I just kind of got to embrace.
Because I feel like learning and personal development is really important to you. And you're one of the few fitness people that I follow for the very reason that I feel like you're so knowledgeable. But is it sometimes frustrating to you, because you're kind of Insta famous, that people perhaps don't know that you're actually as knowledgeable as you are, or perhaps that you're just like an Instagram PT rather than a real one?
Well, completely. Like, I literally wrote about this today, because I have a massive insecurity complex about like my job, and I seem to chameleon myself to whatever situation I'm in. But like, my passion is fitness. I love it, and I'm very, very passionate about working with others and being a really good personal trainer. But, you know, the last few years have been really busy, and I feel like I've not been able to dedicate as many hours as I would have liked to really honing my craft. And I've had such an insecurity complex about it, because we've all got that little voice in our head that's like, you're not doing good enough. Everyone's talking about you. Everyone's saying you're shit. And I really have that. And it's something that I'm dealing with on a daily basis. Like, I do feel like there are probably people out there that are like, why does Alice get given all this stuff? Why does she get to teach it X, Y, and Z? Why does she get asked to do this? You know, she's a shit PT. And
I don't think anyone's saying that.
Well, maybe they're not. But I think sometimes I do have that real feeling of people saying that, and it's something I have to work on myself. But I think it's a good thing, because I think I will therefore never stop wanting to learn and get better. You know, for all that is bad about that, and for all that I should try and ignore it, it also does motivate me to want to be better every single day and to know that I can always know more. You know, I think the worst thing you can think of yourself is as being an expert, because I don't think you're ever an expert. I think there's always something more you can know. And particularly in personal training, there is always something new, and there will always be someone that will challenge you, and there will always be someone which will make you think, oh, hang on a second, I used to do things this way with people, but actually you've made me question that and do it differently. And I think I'm almost in a better position, therefore, because I think I'm able to therefore be so motivated to want to be better and to learn, and I'm hungry for knowledge, and that's what makes me a great PT. You know, I might not be an expert, and I might not be the best trainer out there, and I might not have as many hours as other people, but I will always try and be better, and I will always try and improve whatever it is that I'm doing now. So, yeah, you know, I might come to a stage in God knows how long, in 5, 10, 15 years, and be like, okay, I really feel confident in my skill set now. Now is not that time, but that's not to say I'll never get there. It just means that I have got a fun journey of learning ahead.
Yeah, I think it's a hard balance, because you need a bit of that inner critic, don't you? Mm-hmm. Like you said, to push yourself, if we all just sat back and thought we were great, we would never develop. Mm-hmm. But then not too much that you just feel rubbish the whole time.
Exactly.
Fine balance.
Exactly.
And then talk to me about your name change. So you used to be Clean Eating Alice, you ditched that, you moved on to your real name. What did that decision process look like?
It was such a long time coming. I felt so conflicted by the name that I'd chosen when I started my Instagram page, which was, you know, in my student digs, and I had no idea that it would receive the negative connotations that it did. I just felt like it didn't, encapsulate everything that I was doing. And I just felt like I was being lumped together with a load of really negative stuff that I really was trying to move away from. It was like, sat down with my management. I was like, I want to change it. I want it to be my name. You know, I feel like I am my own brand and I'm going to own it. And so we did it.
That was that. You've got a great name for fitness.
I mean, it's really handy.
It's almost like it was meant to be. It is very handy indeed. And then your third turning point in your career, you've listed as your women's health cover.
Yeah.
That is pretty major. And those photos were just everywhere and still are everywhere the whole time.
Yeah, it was just a real honour. Like, it's a massive thing. And I was the first ever influencer kind of cover they'd done. It was just the moment where I think, you know, people like my grandparents and my mum were like, oh, okay, she's actually doing really well now. Like, this is pretty mega. It's not my most proudest achievement. It's just something where I was like, you know, it sounds so bad, but like, you know, people at school messaging, they're like, oh wow, actually you were doing really well. Like, it was one of those.
Yeah.
I had that sort of like inner smugness of being like, oh, okay, yeah, I am. Like, I don't pat myself on the back very often. I'm really, really bad at doing that. I'm so, so self-critical. But it was one of those moments where I was like, actually, like, I'm pretty pleased, pretty proud of myself today. And that's like a real, really cool achievement. And look, like, there are so many critics of women's magazines, and I absolutely agree with some of what they say. And I'm not sitting here saying, you know, I absolutely agree with all the messaging that goes down in women's magazines. But for that moment and in that time, I was like, I'm just going to enjoy it. I'm just going to be proud of myself and enjoy this moment.
Did you have any anxieties leading up to the shoot? I feel like I would have been so nervous.
Oh my God, of course. Like, we all do. You know, if someone says they're going to put you on the cover of a magazine, you're like, what the hell? But thankfully, they're an amazing team. Like, I really have a lot of respect and love for a lot of the people that work at Women's Health. They work incredibly hard, and they made it a very enjoyable process. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'm very proud of you.
Thank you.
If I'd gone to school with you, I would have been very jealous and annoyed. But I know exactly what I mean. I did an event a few weeks ago, and the audience was loads of people I'd gone to school with. I thought, well, this is quite fun, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is. Take your
it's
moment.
One of those things. You know, when you go back at your, like, 10-year reunion, and you're like, oh, yeah. Remember you.
Coming up from the woodwork. We talked a lot about the positivity in the online space, but it must come with a lot of negative stuff as well. Can we just talk briefly about the pressures of being an online person and as Insta famous as you are, and how do you deal with that? Do you ever just want to quit the internet?
Many times. Many times. I used to love blogging. I used to and I say blogging, I mean, you know, Instagram mainly. I do have a website and a blog, but mainly on Instagram. I used to love it. Where I am now is that I love bits of it. I also really don't like bits of it. I feel like it's gotten so big and so saturated that I can almost see the bubble bursting quite soon. I also, you know, when I first started, there was so much realness on there. Mm. You know, it was so much more instant. There was less editing. It was just, you know, this is what I'm doing and this is where I am and this is what I'm eating. And that's what I did as well. And I've just seen it become this kind of professional portfolio of incredible photos. And like, I'm going to be totally honest, there are times when it makes me feel deeply, deeply insecure. Mm. And I find that really, really hard because it completely zaps my creativity. Mm. It zaps my motivation to create content. And, like, it makes me feel like giving up, really, some of the time. Because I'm like, oh, God, why do I bother? And also, to a certain extent, like, am I contributing to the problem? Mm. Am I further exacerbating the issue that I think the internet and social media is making people feel really shit about themselves? Yeah. But then I think, actually, no, you know, if you don't put out positive stuff and if you don't, for example, with the Women's Aid stuff, you know, the exercise content that I try and put out and the sort of real stuff that I try and get out there, then there'll be one less person doing that and there'll be one less person sort of like banging that drum. And I don't necessarily know if I'd be comfortable with that. I think for me right now, I'm like, I just need to find a very good balance with it where I go on there for work. Mm. And, you know, I there are certain accounts that I love to follow, don't get me wrong, but that I really am mindful of the amount of time that I spend on it. Mm. Like today I've had one of those days where I was supposed to be recording something all morning and it got moved. So I suddenly had this like 4-hour gap and I had work to do, but like, you know, when it's like work, it's not, it wasn't like pressing. And so I found myself like scrolling Instagram, doing a bit of work, scrolling Instagram. And before you know it, it's like a couple of hours that you've like been sort of like dabbling in it.
And it's lost in it.
Yeah. And I can feel the effect that has on me. You know, my breathing becomes quite anxious and I'm already someone that is very much of an anxious disposition. And I suffer with anxiety terribly sometimes and I can feel what it's doing to me. And yet I almost keep going back. Mm. So my things that I've done recently that really help are I created a private page where I just follow my closest friends and I love going on there because I genuinely smile when I see what they're up to. You know, I see their stories and like when I see that they've, you know, done completely normal things like get absolutely trashed on the weekend and like, you know, go to a gig or like all those kind of things. And that makes me very happy. And it means that I don't have to consume any of the other stuff that sort of makes me feel anxious. And then the other thing is that sometimes I delete the app, you know, like there's nothing better than stopping you from going on it than it not being there at all. So if you can for a couple of days, just be like, right, I'm going to delete it. Or even for a day, it's gone. You don't have to click on it. It's not there. So, yeah, just...
It's a crazy world that we're living in because we know so much about these people that we've never met in real life. I know what they had for breakfast, where they worked out, what they're doing later. I'm like, I've never actually met you and it's really weird.
It's bizarre, yeah.
And it's become our new normal, but it's actually, it's quite perverse in a way and it's not good for our own mental health.
No, and it just leads to so much comparison. Mm. And... You know, if you think about 50 years ago, there was comparison, but there was comparison to perhaps people in magazines, but then like your neighbours and your friends, which is a much smaller circle. If you think about how far and wide our comparison now goes, you know, we're looking at models every day, and we're looking at people that are living these incredible lifestyles, traveling all over the world.
Mm.
And I'm there sort of in my cafe typing with my laptop with like a coffee, being like, oh God, like what am I doing with my life? Like,
well, I think it's also this expectation on content that we need to be putting up like Maldives floating pool shots and stuff like this the whole time, and that people don't want to see the like everyday life. And that can be a pressure on you to have some amazing life when you're just a normal person.
Yeah, I know, I completely agree with you. I think that's really,
do you feel point. Like due to the nature of your industry, you feel a pressure to maintain a certain like aesthetic? Do you ever feel like that's a problem with the platform?
I used to validate my success in my appearance. So, you know, when I think back to, for example, like my women's health covers, that niggling voice in my head was like, you're only getting this because of your body. You're only getting this because of your abs. Like, basically, I was Alice with the abs, and that was who I was. And if I didn't go to an event and not have my abs out, it was like, oh, what are you doing? You know, like, people are there to see, like, your body. How wrong I could have been, yeah. Like, I think... I remember when I started to realise that, you know, I brought more to the table than just my physique. And I started to realise that actually there were lots of different people that I admired and that I was inspired by who didn't look like me, who were maybe in bigger bodies, or who were, you know, not getting their body out every day, but were so great in other ways. And I was suddenly like, hang on a second, like... I can do loads of amazing things, and I've got so many skills and so many wonderful talents, and I'm proud to say that go beyond just the way I look. And if I can start to appreciate myself for all those things, maybe other people will start to appreciate it too. And I remember, like, even just starting to change the way I dressed. Like, you know, I used to go out in like jeans and a crop top because I was desperate to show off like my body and be proud of that. And then, you know, I started to wear dresses more and just feel more like confident in my skin, because even despite the fact that I was going out wearing crop tops, actually probably that was when I was most insecure about the way I looked, which is weird. And I think people find that really difficult to get their head around, you know, like if you go out half naked, you assume that person must be like massively confident in the way they look. But actually, like for me, it was just a massive cover up for like, I'm deeply insecure about the way I look.
Yeah.
Whereas when I started to like enjoy fashion, you know, wear things that I actually, you know, not buying the smallest size, but actually getting size that properly fitted me and feeling good in clothes and not having, you know, things that cut in, but actually just wearing something that was, you know, comfortable. That was really massive. And just understanding that, like, I bring so much more to the table than just the way I look. And I think it came from a number of things, like my mentor, Andy, like I've got a lot to thank him for, because... He's a personal trainer. He's an amazing trainer. And the reason why I love him is because he's so wise. And when in his sessions, he like delivers so much information to me that I'd be like, oh, I want to be like you. I don't want to be on the gym floor in a crop top being like, train with me because I look like this. I want people to come and train with me because like I can give them all of this information and help them in such an incredible way that it wouldn't matter what I look like. They just want to listen to what I have to say. And that was really a turning point for me. But also I started to like diversify who I was following. You know, I just finished an interview with Bryony Gordon, and I remember following her and being like, pup, she's running the marathon and I'm terrified of doing the marathon, but if she can do it, well then like I can. And like just realizing that there are all sorts of bodies that exercise. You don't have to be Alice with a six pack to enjoy exercising and to like be good at it, you know?
I can imagine how difficult that was though, when you've had so much public attention on you, you know, splashed all over like the Daily Mail and everything for looking a certain way, and then you say, I want to relax or whatever it is. That's very hard.
Yeah, it was. And there was definitely a teething period where I was like, oh God, I feel really uncomfortable. But, you know, the more that I instilled in myself that I was doing so much other stuff that was great, the better I felt about the way that my body was changing.
I had an amazing guest on this season called Callie Thorpe.
I
love Callie as well. And we were talking about very similar stuff this morning, where she was saying, I had to learn to love myself, not because of a certain size or whether I could hit a goal weight. She's like, just love myself as I am.
Yeah, and can I just say that, like, I am so here for that. But the thing I must say here is, to those that think that it's like this automatic switch that you're like, I love myself and therefore I'm going to be happy for the rest of my life, the end. It's not. Mm. There are days where I don't feel great about myself. Still, there are days where I look in the mirror and I think, oh my God, like, I just need to turn away. Like, I don't feel great today. I'm on my period. You know, all those kind of things that we go through.
Yeah.
But if you can start to just have, like, almost that daily mantra, and I'm sure Callie said the same thing, you know, it's not a permanent state of being. It's a daily habit. It's
something you're working
it's
on.
It's something you have to constantly work on. And it's less about love and it's more about acceptance for me. Mm. It's less about being like, I absolutely love every single part of myself. It's more like, I accept who and where I am today, regardless of how I feel.
Mm.
I just accept. And that, for me, is different.
Mm.
It's not about, you know, me saying, like, I can't claim to be a body positivity activist because I've never lived in a bigger body and I don't know what that's like, and I can't speak for those people, and that would be so wrong of me to do that. But in my experience of what I've gone through, I can certainly say that to love my body feels still quite difficult. To accept feels easy. Mm. To just say, this is who I am today, and I'm just going to accept it, and, you know, that's all that I can do. And that, for me, is very, very empowering.
Mm.
And, you know, I absolutely champion people like Callie because I think she inspires me massively, you know, as do so many other people. And I think that diversity and that visibility of bodies that are all different shapes and sizes is so key to us looking down at our own body and being like, yeah, I'm cool. Like,
I am. Whatever, I'm down with this.
Whatever it is, I'm good. You know, I don't look like the girls in the magazine, but neither does anyone.
Yeah.
The girl in the magazine doesn't look like the girl in the magazine.
Have you seen the Brené Brown special?
No.
Oh my God, it's amazing on Netflix. She's had a viral TED talk, but she's like, I've done so much work on myself. I like myself too much. Oh. Like, that's the kind of attitude that I want
to
channel.
That sounds great. Okay, I need to watch that. That's going to be on my list.
But yeah, very good.
I think that's so important because, you know, none of us look like these airbrushed perfect images that we see in the magazines.
Yeah.
And the more that we see reality and the more that we see everything, you know, the good, the bad, the ugly, the better we can feel about ourselves.
The world needs more Callie thoughts.
They do.
And finally, just quickly, will you tell me a little bit about your podcast?
Give Me Strength, the podcast, was my desire to speak to all different types of women who have found an inner resilience from finding physical strength. So we have had such a diverse range of guests. I mean, I've just, like I said, spoken to the incredible Bryony Gordon. My guest that is coming out this week, as we record, I don't know when this is coming out, but this week, is a woman called Martine Wright, and she lost both her legs in the 7/7 bombings and then went on to compete in the Paralympics.
Wow.
We've had Dame Jess Ennis-Hill, and all sorts of people. And basically, you know, for me, it's the podcast that I wish I'd have heard maybe 2 or 3 years ago, where I listen and realise that there are so many different types of people that exercise, and so many different shapes, sizes, ages of people that just move for movement's sake. And, you know, yes, okay, we speak to some elite athletes, but I think speaking to them reaffirms that they go through all of the same issues that you or I go through, you know, that fear, that comparison, that fear of failure, all of those things. But then speaking to complete everyday athletes too, you know, someone like Bryony, who went from not being able to run for a bus to doing 2 marathons, that to me is like, wow, what a woman, you know, like how incredibly inspiring is that? And so, yeah, I hope it's the perfect inspiration and motivation for anyone that's starting out, either starting out on their exercise journey or on it in some way, to just think, yeah, I can do this.
Well, it sounds absolutely amazing. I'm very much looking forward to the Bryony episode.
Thank you
so much for being such a wonderful guest, Alice. If people would like to find out more about you, where should they go?
Thank you for having me. I am on Instagram at Alice Living, and that's got an annoying E in it, and same on Twitter, same on Facebook.
Thank you, Alice.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to She Started It with Angelica Malin. If you've enjoyed this episode, then don't forget to subscribe, rate and review. And you can follow me on Twitter at Jelly Malin.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.